both cases, Magnus could hear them using the capitals for emphasis. "Don't fret," Magnus said airily. "I no longer want to go be a cactus and live in the desert." Katerina blinked and winced, visibly having a flashback.
"Not what I was referring to, but good to know. I meant about humans, about love."
Magnus did not particularly want to think about whatever he had been babbling piteously about on the night when he'd gotten his heart broken. There was no point in wallowing. Magnus refused to wallow. Wallowing was for elephants, depressing people, and depressing elephants. Katerina continued, despite the lack of encouragement.
"I was born this color. I did not know how to wear a glamour as a newborn. There was no way to look like anything but what I was then, all the time, even though it was not safe. My mother saw me and knew what I was, but she hid me from the world. She raised me in secret. She did everything she could to keep me safe. A great wrong was done to her, and she gave back love. Every human I heal in her name. I do what I do to honor her, and to know that when she saved my life, she saved countless lives through the centuries."
She turned a wide, serious gaze to Ragnar, who was sitting at the table and looking at his hands uncomfortably, but who responded to the cue.
"My parents thought I was a fairy child or something, I think," Ragnar said. "Because I was the color of springtime, my mother used to say," he added and blushed emerald. "Obviously, it all came out as a bit more complicated than that, but by then, they'd gotten fond of me. They were always fond of me, even though I was unsettling to have around the place, and Mother told me that I was grouchy as a baby. I outgrew that, of course."
A polite silence followed this statement. A fairy child would be easier to accept, Magnus thought, than that demons had tricked or hurt a woman, or more rarely a man, and now there was a marked child to remind the parent of their pain.
Warlocks were always born from that, from pain and demons.
"It is something to remember if we feel distant from humans," Katerina said. "We owe a great deal to human love. We live forever by the grace of human love, which rocked strange children in their cradles and did not despair and did not turn away. I know which side of my heritage my soul comes from."
They were sitting outside their house in a garden surrounded by high walls, but Katerina was always the most cautious of them all. She looked around in the dark before she lit the candle on the table, light springing from nothing before her cupped hands and turning her white hair to silk and pearls. In the sudden light, Magnus could see her smile.
"Our fathers were demons," said Katerina.
"Our mothers were heroes." That was true, of course, for them. Most warlocks were born wearing unmistakable signs of what they were, and some warlock children died young because their parents abandoned or killed what they saw as unnatural creatures. Some were raised, as Katerina and Ragnar had been, in love that was greater than fear. Magnus's warlock's mark was his eyes, the pupils slit, the color lucent and green-gold at the wrong angles. But these features had not developed immediately. He had not been born with Katerina's blue or Ragnar's green skin. He had been born a seemingly human baby with unusual amber eyes. Magnus's mother had not realized his father was a demon for some time, not until she had gone to the cradle one morning and seen her child staring back at her with the eyes of a cat. She knew then what had happened, that whatever had come to her in the night in the shape of her husband had not been her husband. When she realized that, she had not wanted to go on living. And she hadn't. Magnus did not know if she had been a hero or not. He had not been old enough to know about her life, or fully comprehend her pain. He could not be sure in the way Ragnar and Katerina looked sure. He did not know if, when his mother knew the truth, she had still loved him, or if all love had been blotted out by darkness. A darkness greater than the one known by his friends' mothers. For Magnus's father was no ordinary demon. "And I saw Satan fall," Magnus murmured into his drink, "like lightning from heaven." Katerina turned to him.
"What was that?"
"Rejoice that your names are written in heaven, my dear," said Magnus. "I am so touched that I laugh and have another drink so that I may not weep." After that, he took another walk outside. He remembered now why he had told them, on that dark, drunken night, that he wanted to go to Mokewa. Magnus had been to that town only once before, and had not stayed long. Mokewa meant quiet place in Quechua, and that was exactly what the town was, and exactly why Magnus had felt uneasy there. The peaceful cobbled streets, the plaza with its wrought iron fountain where children played, were not for him. Magnus's life philosophy was to keep moving, and in places like Mokewa he understood why it was necessary to keep moving. If he did not, someone might see him as he really was. Not that he thought he was so very dreadful, but there was still that voice in his head like a warning. Keep in bright, constant motion, or the whole illusion will collapse in on itself. Magnus remembered lying in the silver sand of the night desert, and thinking of quiet places where he did not belong, and how sometimes he believed, as he believed in the passage of time and the joy of living and the absolute merciless unfairness of fate, that there was no quiet place in the world for him, and never would be. Thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Nor was it wise to tempt angels, even of the fallen sort. He shook the memory off. Even if that were true, there would always be another adventure. You might think that Magnus's spectacular night of drunken debauchery and countless crimes must be the reason he was banned from Peru, but that is not in fact the case. Amazingly, Magnus was allowed back into Peru. Many years later, he went back, this time alone, and he did indeed find another adventure. 1962. Magnus was strolling through the streets of Cusco, past the convent of La Merced and down the Calle Mantas, when he heard the man's voice. The first thing he noticed was how nasal said voice was. The next thing he noticed was that he was speaking English.
I don't care what you say, Kitty. I maintain that we could have gotten a bus to Machu Picchu.
Jeffrey, there are no buses to Machu Picchu from New York.
Well, really, said Jeffrey, after a pause. If the National Geographic Society is going to put the wretched place in their paper, they might at least have arranged a bus.
Magnus was able to spot them then, wending their way through the arches that lined the street once you were past the bell tower. Jeffrey had the nose of a man who never shut up. It was peeling in the hot sun and arid air, and the once crisp edges of his white trousers were wilting like a sad, dying flower.
Another thing here is the natives, said Jeffrey. I'd hoped we could get some decent pictures. I expected them to be so much more colorful, don't you know?
It's almost as if they were not here for your entertainment, said Magnus in Spanish.
Kitty turned around at the sound, and Magnus saw a small, mocking face and red hair curling underneath the brim of a very large straw hat. Her lips were curling, too. Jeffrey turned when she turned.
Oh, well spotted, old girl, he said. Now he's what I call colorful.
That much was true. Magnus was wearing more than a dozen scarves, all in different colors, and carefully arrayed to swirl about him like a fantastic rainbow. He was not too impressed by Jeffrey's powers of observation, however, since Jeffrey was apparently unable to imagine that anyone with brown skin could possibly be a visitor himself.
I say, fellow, do you want to have your picture taken? Said Jeffrey.
You're an idiot, Magnus told him, smiling brightly. Magnus was still speaking in Spanish. Kitty choked on a laugh and turned it into a cough.
Ask him, Kitty, said Jeffrey, with the air of one prompting a dog to do a trick.
I apologize for him, she said in halting Spanish.
Magnus smiled and offered his arm with a flourish. Kitty skipped over the flagstones, worn so smooth by time that the stone was like water, and seized his arm.
Oh, charming, charming! Mother will love to see these shots, said Jeffrey enthusiastically.
How do you put up with him? Magnus inquired.
Kitty and Magnus beamed like actors, toothy, ecstatic, and entirely insincere.
With some difficulty.
Let me offer you an alternate proposition, Magnus said between the locked teeth of his smile. Run away with me. Right now. It will be the most amazing adventure, I promise you that.
Kitty stared at him. Jeffrey turned around in quest of someone who could take shots of all of them together. Behind Jeffrey's back, Magnus saw Kitty begin, slowly and delightedly, to smile.
Oh, all right, why not?
Excellent, said Magnus. He spun and seized her hand, and they ran, laughing together down the sunlit street.
We better go pretty quickly, Kitty shouted, voice breathless as they rushed. He's bound to notice soon that I stole his watch. Magnus blinked.
Pardon?
There was a noise behind them. It sounded disturbingly like a ruckus. Magnus was, through hardly any fault of his own, somewhat familiar with the sound of the police being summoned and also the sounds of hot pursuit. He pulled Kitty into an alleyway. She was still laughing and undoing the buttons of her blouse.
It will probably take them a little longer, she murmured, the mother-of-pearl buttons parting enough to show the sudden, rich flash of emeralds and rubies, to realize that I also stole all his mother's jewels.
She gave Magnus a little saucy smile. Magnus burst out laughing. Do you con a lot of annoying rich men?
And their mothers, said Kitty. I could probably have taken them for the whole family fortune, or at least the silver. But a handsome man asked me to run away with him, and I thought, what the hell?
The sound of pursuit was closer now. You're about to be very glad you did, Magnus told her. Since you showed me yours, I believe it's only fair I show you mine. He snapped his fingers, making sure to trail blue sparks to impress the lady. Kitty was clever enough to realize what was going on as soon as one of the first pursuers glanced down the alleyway and ran on.
They can't see us, she breathed. You turned us invisible.
Magnus raised his eyebrows and made a gesture of display. As you see, he said, and they don't. Magnus had seen humans shocked and scared and amazed by his power. Kitty flung herself into his arms. Tell me, stranger, she said. How do you feel about a life of magical crime?
Sounds like an adventure, said Magnus. But promise me something. Promise we will always steal from the irritating and spend the cash on booze and useless trinkets.
Kitty pressed a kiss to his mouth. I swear. They fell in love, not even for a mortal lifetime, but for a mortal summer, a summer of laughing and running and being wanted by the law in several different countries. In the end, Magnus's favorite memory of that summer was an image he had never seen. The last picture on Jeffrey's camera. Of a man trailing bright colors and a woman hiding them beneath a white blouse, both smiling because they knew a joke he did not. Magnus's sudden turn to a life of crime, shockingly enough, was not the reason he was banned from Peru either. The High Council of Peruvian Warlocks met in secret, and a letter was sent to Magnus several months later announcing that he had been banned from Peru, on pain of death, for crimes unspeakable. Despite his inquiries, he never received an answer to the question of what he had been banned for. To this day, whatever it is that actually got him banned from Peru is, and perhaps must always remain, a mystery.
The Runaway Queen by Cassandra Clare and Maureen Johnson. Read by George Blagden.
Paris, June 1791. There was a smell to Paris in the summer mornings that Magnus enjoyed. This was surprising, because on summer mornings Paris smelled of cheese that had sat in the sun all day, and fish, and the less desirable parts of fish. It smelled of people, and all the things that people produce. This does not refer to art or culture, but to the baser things that were dumped out of windows in buckets. But these were punctuated by other odours, and the odours would shift rapidly from street to street, or building to building. That heady whiff of a bakery might be followed by an unexpected flush of gardenias in a garden, which gave way to the iron-rich pong of a slaughterhouse. Paris was nothing if not alive, the Seine pumping along like a great artery, the vessels of the wider streets, narrowing down to the tiniest alleys, and every inch of it had a smell. It all smelled of life, life in every form and degree. The smells today, however, were a bit strong. Magnus was taking an unfamiliar route, one that took him through quite a rough patch of Paris. The road here was not as smooth. It was brutally hot inside his cabriolet as it bumped its way along. Magnus had animated one of his magnificent Chinese fans, and it flapped ineffectively at him, barely stirring the breeze. It was, if he was completely honest with himself, and he did not want to be, a bit too hot for this new striped blue and rose-coloured coat, made of taffeta and satin, and the silk faye waistcoat embroidered with a scene of birds and cherubs, the wing collar, and the wig, and the silk breeches, the wonderful new gloves in the most delicate lemon yellow. It was all a bit warm. Still, if one could look this fabulous, one had an obligation to. One should wear everything, or one should wear nothing at all. He settled back into his seat and accepted the sweat proudly, glad that he lived by his principles, principles which were widely embraced in Paris. In Paris, people were always after the latest fashion. Wigs that hit the ceiling and had miniature boats in them. Outrageous silks. White paint and high blushed cheeks on the men and the women. The decorative beauty spots. The tailoring. The colours. In Paris, one could have the eyes of a cat, as he did, and tell people it was a trick of fashion. In a world such as this, there was much work for an enterprising warlock. The aristocracy loved a bit of magic and were willing to pay for it. They paid for luck at the pharaoh table. They paid him to make their monkeys speak, to make their birds sing their favorite arias from the opera, to make their diamonds glow in different colors. They wanted beauty spots in the shapes of hearts, champagne glasses, and stars to spontaneously appear on their cheeks. They wanted to dazzle their guests by having fire shoot from their fountains, and then to amuse those same guests by having their chaise longues wander across the room. And their lists of requests for the bedroom. Well, he kept careful notes on those. They were nothing if not imaginative. In short, the people of Paris and the neighboring royal town of Versailles were the most decadent people Magnus had ever met, and for this, he revered them deeply. Of course, the revolution had put a damper on some of this. Magnus was daily reminded of that fact, even now as he pulled back the blue silk curtains of the carriage. He received a few penetrating looks from the sans-culottes, pushing their carts or selling their cat meat. Magnus kept apartments in the Marais, on the Rue Barbette, quite near the Hôtel de Soubise, home of his old and recently deceased friend, the Prince of Soubise. Magnus had an open invitation to wander the gardens or entertain himself there any time he chose. In fact, he could walk into any number of great houses in Paris and be warmly greeted. His aristocratic friends were silly but mostly harmless. But now it was problematic to be seen in their company. Sometimes it was problematic to be seen at all. It was no longer a good thing to be very rich or well-connected. The unwashed masses, producers of the stink, had taken over France, overturning everything in their unwashed path. His feelings about the revolution were mixed. People were hungry. The price of bread was still very high. It did not help that the Queen, Marie Antoinette, when told that her people could not afford bread, had suggested that they eat cake instead. It was sensible to him that the people should demand and receive food, and firewood, and all the basic needs of life. Magnus always felt for the poor and the wretched. But at the same time, never had there been a society quite as wonderful as that of France at its dizzying heights and excesses. And while he liked excitement, he also liked to have some sense of what was going on, and that feeling was in short supply. No one quite knew who was in charge of the country. The revolutionaries squabbled all the time. The constitution was always being written. The king and queen were alive and supposedly still somewhat in power, but they were controlled by the revolutionaries. Periodically, there would be killings, fires, or attacks, all in the name of liberation. Living in Paris was like living in a powder keg that was stacked on top of several other powder kegs, which were in a ship tossing blindly at sea. There was always the feeling that one day the people, the undefined people, just might decide to kill everyone who could afford a hat. Magnus sighed and leaned back out of the range of prying eyes and put a jasmine-scented cloth to his nose. Enough stink and bother. He was off to see a balloon. Of course, Magnus had flown before. He'd animated carpets and rested upon the backs of migrating flocks of birds. But he'd never flown by a human hand. This ballooning thing was new and, frankly, a little alarming. Just shooting up into the air in a fabulous and garish creation with the whole of Paris staring at you. This, of course, was why he had to try it. The hot air balloon craze had largely passed him by when it had first been the rage of Paris, almost 10 years before. But just the other day, when Magnus had had perhaps a little too much wine, he'd looked up and seen one of the sky-blue, egg-shaped wonders drifting past, with its gold illustrations of zodiacal signs and fleur-de-lis, and all at once he'd been overcome with the desire to get into its basket and ride over the city. It had been a whim, and there was nothing Magnus attached more importance to than a whim. He'd managed to track down one of the Montgolfier brothers that very day, and had paid far too many louis d'or for a private ride. And now that Magnus was on his way to take said ride on this hot afternoon, he reflected back on just how much wine he had drunk on the afternoon when he had set this all up. It had been quite a lot of wine. His carriage finally came to a stop near the Château de la Mouette, once a beautiful little palace, now falling apart. Magnus stepped out into the swampy afternoon and walked into the park. There was a heavy, oppressive feel to the air that made Magnus's wonderful clothes hang heavily. He walked along the path until he came to the meeting spot, where his balloon and its crew awaited him. The balloon was deflated on the grass, the silk just as beautiful as ever, but the overall effect not as impressive as he had hoped. He had better dressing gowns when it came down to it. One of the Montgolfiers, Magnus could not remember which one he had hired, came rushing up to him with a flushed face.
"Monsieur Bane, je suis désolé, monsieur, but the weather, oh, today it will not cooperate. It is most annoying. I've seen a flash of lightning in the distance."
Sure enough, as soon as these words were spoken, there was a distant rumble, and the sky did have a greenish cast.
"Flight is not possible today. Tomorrow, perhaps. Alain, the balloon! Move it at once!"
And with that, the balloon was rolled up and carried to a small gazebo. Dismayed, Magnus decided to have a turn around the park before the weather deteriorated. One could see the most fetching ladies and gentlemen walking there, and it did seem to be a place that people came to when they were feeling amorous. No longer a private wooded area and park, the Bois de Boulogne was now open to the people, who used the wonderful grounds for growing potatoes for food. They also wore cotton and proudly called themselves sans culottes, meaning without knee breeches. They wore long, workmanlike pants, and they cast long, judgmental looks at Magnus's own exquisite breeches, which matched the rose-coloured stripe in his jacket and his faintly silver stockings. It really was getting difficult to be wonderful. Also, the park seemed singularly devoid of handsome, love-struck persons. It was all long trousers and long looks, and people mumbling about the latest revolutionary craze. The more noble sorts all looked nervous and turned their gazes to the path whenever a member of the Third Estate walked by. But Magnus did see someone he knew, and he wasn't happy about it. Coming toward him at great speed was Henri de Polignac, dressed in black and silver. Henri was a darkling of Saint-Cloud, who was the head of the most powerful clan of vampires in Paris. Henri was also a terrible bore. Most subjugates were. It was hard to have a conversation with someone who was always saying, "Master says this," and "Master says that." Always grovelling. Always lingering about, waiting to be bitten. Magnus had to wonder what Henri was doing out in the park during the day. The answer was certainly something bad. Hunting, recruiting, and now, bothering Magnus.
"Monsieur Bane," he said, with a short bow.
"Henri?"
"It's been some time since we've seen you."
"Oh," Magnus said airily, "I've been quite busy. Business, you know. Revolution."
"Of course. But Master was just saying how long it's been since he's seen you. He was wondering if you'd fallen off the face of the earth."
"No, no," Magnus said. "Just keep him busy."
"As is Master," Henri said with a twisted little smile. "You really must come by. Master is having a party on Monday evening. He would be very cross with me if I did not invite you."
"Would he?" Magnus said, swallowing down the slightly bitter taste that had risen in his mouth.
"He would indeed."
One did not turn down an invitation from Saint-Cloud. At least, one didn't if one wanted to continue living contentedly in Paris. Vampires took offense so easily, and Parisian vampires were the worst of all. "Of course," Magnus said,
delicately peeling one of his lemon-yellow gloves from his hand simply for something to do. Of course. I would be delighted. Most delighted.
I will tell Master you will be in attendance, Henri replied.
The first drops of rain began to fall, landing heavily on Magnus's delicate jacket. At least this allowed him to say his goodbyes quickly. As he hurried across the grass, Magnus put up his hand. Blue sparks webbed between his fingers, and instantly the rain no longer struck him. It rolled off an invisible canopy he had conjured just over his head. Paris. It was problematic sometimes. So political. Oh, his shoes. His shoes. Oh, why had he worn the silk ones with the curled toes today? He had known he'd be in a park. But they were new and pretty and by Jacques of the Rue des Ballets and could not be resisted. Perhaps it was best, in the current climate, to consider retiring to somewhere simpler. London was always a good retreat. Not as fashionable, but not without its charms. Or he could go to the Alps. Yes, he did love the clean, fresh air. He could frolic through the Edelweiss and enjoy the thermal baths of Schinznachbad. Or farther afield. It had been too long since he'd been to India, after all. And he could never resist the joys of Peru. Perhaps it was best to stay in Paris. He got inside the cabriolet just as the skies truly opened, and the rain drummed down so hard on the roof that he could no longer hear his thoughts. The balloon maker's assistants hurriedly covered the balloon works, and the people scurried for cover under trees. The flowers seemed to brighten in the splash of the rain, and Magnus took a great deep breath of the Paris air he loved so well. As they drove off, a potato hit the side of his carriage. The day, in a very literal sense, appeared to be a wash. There was only one thing for it, a long, cool bath with a cup of hot lapsang souchong. He would bathe by the window and drink in the smoky tea, and watch the rain drench Paris. Then he would recline and read Le Pied de Fanchette and Shakespeare for several hours. Then some violet champagne and an hour or two to dress for the opera.
Marie! Magnus called as he entered the house. Bath!
He kept as staff an older couple, Marie and Claude. They were extremely good at their jobs, and years of service in Paris had left them completely unsurprised by anything. Of the many places he had lived, Magnus found his Paris house to be one of the most pleasing abodes. Certainly there were places of greater natural beauty, but Paris had unnatural beauty, which was arguably better. Everything in the house gave him pleasure. The silk wallpaper in yellow and rose and silver and blue, the ormolu tables and giltwood armchairs, the clocks and mirrors and porcelains. With every step he took farther into the house, to his main salon, he was reminded of the good of the place. Many downworlders stayed away from Paris. There were certainly many werewolves in the country, and every wooded glen had its fae. But Paris, it seemed, was the terrain of the vampire. It made sense in many ways. Vampires were courtly creatures. They were pale and elegant. They enjoyed darkness and pleasure. Their hypnotic gazes, the incanto, enchanted many a noble. And there was nothing quite as pleasurable, decadent, and dangerous as letting a vampire drink your blood. It had all gotten a bit out of hand during the vampire craze of 1787, though. That's when the blood parties had started. That's when all the children had gone missing, and some other young people first returned home pale and with the absent look of the subjugate. Like Henri and his sister Brigitte. They were the nephew and niece of the Duc de Polignac. Once beloved members of one of the great families of France, they now lived with Saint-Cloud and did his bidding. And Saint-Cloud's bidding could be a strange thing indeed. Magnus didn't mind a little decadence. But Saint-Cloud was evil. Classic, straightforward evil of the most old-fashioned type. The shadow hunters of the Paris Institute seemed to have little effect on the goings-on, possibly because in Paris there were many places to hide. There were miles of catacombs, and it was extremely easy to snatch someone from the street and drag them below. Saint-Cloud had friends in places high and low, and it would have been very difficult to go after him. Magnus did all he could to avoid the Parisian vampires and the vampires who appeared on the edges of the court at Versailles. No good ever came of an encounter. But enough of that. Time for the bath, which Marie was already filling. Magnus kept a large tub in his main salon, right by the window, so he could watch the street below as he bathed. When the water was ready, he submerged himself and began reading. An hour or so later, he had dropped his book bathside, and was watching some clouds pass overhead while absently thinking about the story of Cleopatra dissolving an invaluable pearl in a glass of wine. There was a knock on his chamber door, and Claude entered.
"There is a man here to see you, Monsieur Bain."
Claude understood that in Magnus's business it was not necessary to take names. "All right," Magnus said with a sigh. "Show him in."
"Will Monsieur be receiving his visitor in the bath?"
"Monsieur is considering it," Magnus said, with an even deeper sigh. It was annoying, but professional appearances had to be kept. He stepped out, dripping, and put on a silk dressing gown embroidered on the back with the picture of a peacock. He threw himself petulantly into a chair by the window.
"Claude," he yelled. "Now, send him in."
A moment later the door opened again, and there stood a very attractive man with black hair and blue eyes. He wore clothes of an obviously fine quality. The tailoring was absolutely delicious. This was the sort of thing Magnus wanted to happen more often. How generous the universe could be when she wanted to be. After denying him his balloon ride and giving him such an unpleasant encounter with Henri.
"You are Monsieur Magnus Bain," the man said with certainty.
Magnus was rarely misidentified. Tall, golden-skinned, cat-eyed men were rare.
"I am," Magnus replied.
Many nobles Magnus had met had the absent-minded air of people who had never had to take care of any matters of importance. This man was different. He had a very erect bearing and a look of purpose. Also, he spoke French with a faint accent. But what kind of accent, Magnus could not immediately place.
"I have come to speak to you on a matter of some urgency. I wouldn't normally,
Magnus knew this hesitation well. Some people were nervous in the presence of warlocks.
"You are uncomfortable, sir," Magnus said with a smile.
"Allow me to make you comfortable. I have a great talent in these matters. Please, sit. Have some champagne."
"I prefer to stand, monsieur."
"As you wish. But may I have the pleasure of learning your name?" Magnus asked.
"My name is Count Axel von Fersen."
A count? Named Axel? A military man? With black hair and blue eyes? And in a state of distress? Oh, the universe had outdone herself. The universe would be sent flowers.
"Monsieur Bain, I have heard of your talents. I can't say whether I believe what I've heard, but rational, intelligent, sensible people swear to me that you are capable of wonderful things beyond my understanding."
Magnus spread his hands in false modesty.
"It's all true," he said, "as long as it was wonderful." "They say you can alter a person's appearance by some sort of conjuring trick."
Magnus allowed this insult to pass.
"Monsieur," von Fersen said, "what are your feelings on the revolution?"
"The revolution will happen regardless of my feelings on the matter," Magnus said coolly. "I am not a native son of France, so I do not presume to have opinions on how the nation conducts itself."
"And I am not a son of France either. I am from Sweden, but I do have feelings on this, very strong feelings."
Magnus liked it when von Fersen talked about his very strong feelings. He liked it very much.
"I come here because I must, and because you are the only person who can help. By coming here today and telling you what I am going to tell you, I put my life in your hands. I also risk lives much more valuable than mine, but I do not do so blindly. I have learned much about you, Monsieur Bain. I know you have many aristocratic friends. I know you have been in Paris for 6 years, and you are well-liked and well-known. and you are said to be a man of your word. Are you, sir, a man of your word?
It really depends upon the word, Magnus said. There are so many wonderful words out there.
Magnus silently cursed himself on his poor knowledge of Swedish. He could have added another witty line. He tried to learn seductive phrases in all languages, but the only Swedish he had ever really needed was, "Do you serve anything aside from pickled fish?" and, "If you wrap me in furs, I can pretend to be your little fuzzy bear."
Von Fersen visibly steadied himself before speaking again. "I need you to save the king and queen. I need you to preserve the royal family of France."
Well, that was certainly an unexpected turn. As if in reply, the sky darkened again, and there was another rumble of thunder.
"I see," Magnus replied, after a moment. "How does that statement make you feel, monsieur?"
"Quite the same as always," Magnus replied, making sure to keep his calm demeanor. "With my hands." But he felt anything but calm. The peasant women had broken into the palace of Versailles and thrown out the king and queen, who now lived at the Tuileries, that broken-down old palace in the middle of Paris. The people had produced pamphlets detailing the supposed crimes of the royal family. They seemed to focus quite heavily on Queen Marie Antoinette, accusing her of the most terrible things, often sexual. There was no way possible she could have done all of the things the pamphleteers claimed. The crimes were too gross, too immoral, and far too physically challenging. Magnus himself had never attempted half of them. Anything relating to the royal family was bad and dangerous to know, which made it as appealing as it was frightening.
"Obviously, monsieur, I've just taken a great risk in saying that much to you."
"I realize that," Magnus said. "But save the royal family? No one has harmed them."
"It is only a matter of time," von Fersen said.
His emotion brought a flush to his cheeks that made Magnus's heart flutter a bit.
"They are prisoners. Kings and queens who are imprisoned are generally not freed to rule again."
"No."
"No, it is only a matter of time before the situation grows very dire. It is already intolerable, the conditions under which they are forced to live. The palace is dirty. The servants are cruel and mocking. Every day their possessions and natural entitlements are diminished. I am certain, I am quite certain, if they are not freed, they shall not live. And I cannot live with that knowledge. When they were dragged from Versailles, I sold everything and followed them to Paris. I will follow them anywhere."
"What is it you want me to do?" Magnus said.
"I am told you can alter a person's appearance through some kind of marvel."
Magnus was happy to accept that description of his talents.
"Whatever price you wish, it shall be paid. The royal family of Sweden will also be informed of your great service."
"With all due respect, monsieur," Magnus said, "I do not live in Sweden. I live here. And if I do this..."
"If you do this, you do the greatest service to France.
And when the family is restored to their proper place, you will be honored as a great hero." Again, this made little difference. But what did make a difference was von Fersen himself. It was the blue eyes and the dark hair and the passion and the obvious courage. It was the way he stood, tall and strong.
"Monsieur, will you stand with us? Do we have your word, monsieur?"
It was also a very bad idea. It was a terrible idea. It was the worst idea he had ever heard. It was irresistible.
"Your word, monsieur," Axel said again.
"You have it," Magnus said.
"Then I will come again tomorrow night and lay the plan out in front of you," von Fersen said. "I will show you what must happen."
"I insist we dine together," Magnus said, "if we are to undertake this great adventure together." There was a momentary pause, and then Axel gave a sharp nod.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, I agree. We will dine together."
When von Fersen left, Magnus looked at himself in the mirror for a long time, looking for signs of madness. The actual magic involved was very simple. He could easily get himself in and out of the palace and cast a simple glamour. No one would ever know. He shook his head. This was Paris. Everyone knew everything somehow. He took a long sip of the now warm violet champagne and swished it round his mouth. Any logical doubts he had were drowned out by the beating of his heart. It had been so long since he'd felt the rush. In his mind now, there was only von Fersen. The next night, Magnus had dinner brought in, courtesy of the chef at the Hôtel de Soubise. Magnus's friends permitted his use of the kitchen staff and their excellent foodstuffs when he needed to set an especially fine table. Tonight he had a delicate pigeon bisque, turbot, Rouen duckling with orange, spit-roasted veal, green beans au jus, artichokes, and a table full of cream puffs, fruit, and tiny cakes. The meal was simple enough to arrange. Getting dressed, however, was not. Absolutely nothing was right. He needed something that was flirtatious and fetching, yet businesslike and serious. And at first, it seemed that the lemon-yellow coat and breeches, with the purple waistcoat, fit the bill precisely. But these were discarded for the lime-green waistcoat, and then the violet breeches. He settled on an entire ensemble in a simple cerulean blue, but not before he had emptied out the entire contents of his wardrobe. Waiting was a delicious agony. Magnus could only pace, looking out the window, waiting for von Fersen's carriage to appear. He made countless trips to the mirror, and then to the table Claude and Marie had so carefully laid before he'd sent them away for the evening. Axel had insisted on privacy, and Magnus was happy to oblige. At precisely 8 o'clock, a carriage stopped in front of Magnus's door, and out he stepped. Axel. He even looked up, as if he knew that Magnus would be looking down, waiting for him. He smiled a greeting, and Magnus felt a pleasant kind of sickness, a panic. He hurried down the steps to admit Axel himself. "I've dismissed my staff for the evening, as you asked," he said, trying to regain his composure. "Do come in. Our dinner is ready for us. You'll excuse the informality of my service." "Of course, monsieur," Axel said. But Axel did not linger over his food, or allow himself the pleasures of sipping his wine and taking in Magnus's charms. He launched right into the business at hand. He even had maps, which he unrolled on the sofa. "The escape plan has been developed over several months," he said, picking an artichoke from a silver dish. "By me, some friends of the cause, and the queen herself."
"And the king?" Magnus asked.
"His Majesty has removed himself from the situation somewhat. He is very despondent over the state of things. Her Majesty has assumed much responsibility."
"You seem to be very fond of Her Majesty," Magnus noted carefully.
"She is to be admired," Axel said, dabbing at his lips with his napkin.
"And clearly she trusts you. You must be very close."
"She has graciously allowed me into her confidence."
Magnus could read between the lines. Axel didn't kiss and tell, which made him only more attractive.
"The escape is to be made on Sunday," Axel went on. "The plan is simple, but exacting. We have arranged it so the guards have seen certain people leaving by certain exits at certain times. On the night of the escape, we will substitute the family for these people. The children will be woken at 10:30. The Dauphin will be dressed as a young girl. He and his sister will be removed from the palace by the royal governess, the Marquise de Torzel, and will walk to meet me at the Grand Carousel. I will be driving the traveling carriage. We will then wait for Madame Elizabeth, sister of the king. She shall leave by the same door as the children. When His Majesty finishes his coucher for the evening and is left alone, he will leave as well, disguised as the Chevalier de Coigny. Her Majesty will escape last."
"Marie Antoinette will leave last?"
"It was her decision," von Fersen said quickly. "She is extremely courageous. She demands to go last. If the others are discovered missing, she wishes to sacrifice herself in order to aid their escape."
There was that frisson of passion in his voice again,
But this time when he looked at Magnus, his gaze stayed there for a moment, fixed on the cat-like pupils.
So why do you want only the queen glamoured?
Partially it has to do with timing, Axel said. The order in which people must be seen coming and going. His Majesty will be with people right up until his coucher, and he departs instantly after that. Only Her Majesty would be alone in the palace for some time. She is also more recognizable.
Than the king?
But of course, His Majesty is not a handsome man. Gazes do not linger on his face. What people recognize are his clothes and carriage, all the external signs of his royal status. But Her Majesty, her face is known. Her face is studied and drawn and painted. Her style is copied. She is beautiful, and her face has been committed to many a memory.
I see, Magnus said, wanting to move away from the subject of the Queen's beauty. And what will happen to you?
I will drive the carriage as far as Bondi, he said, his gaze still fixed on Magnus.
He continued to list details. Troop movements, stations to change the horses, things of that nature. Magnus had no interest in these details. They could not hold his attention like the way the elegant ruff of shirt fabric brushed Axel's chin as he spoke, the heavy plumpness of his lower lip. No king or queen or palace or work of art had anything that could compare with that lower lip.
As for your payment,
these words drew Magnus back in.
The matter of payment is quite simple, Magnus said. I require no money.
Monsieur, Axel said, leaning forward, you do this as a true patriot of France.
I do this, Magnus continued calmly, to develop our friendship. I ask only to see you again when the thing is done.
To see me?
To see you, monsieur.
Axel's shoulders drew back a bit, and he looked down at his plate. For a moment, Magnus thought it was all for nothing, that he had made the wrong move. But then Axel looked back up, and the candlelight flickered in his blue eyes.
Monsieur, he said, taking Magnus's hand across the table, we shall be the closest of friends evermore.
This was precisely what Magnus wanted to hear. On Sunday morning, the day of the escape, Magnus woke to the usual clamour of church bells ringing all over Paris. His head was a bit thick and clouded from a long evening with the Condé and a group of actors from the Comédie Italienne. It seemed that during the night he had also acquired a monkey. It sat on the footboard of his bed, happily eating Magnus's morning bread. It had already tipped over the pot of tea that Claude had brought in, and there was a pile of shredded ostrich feathers in the middle of the floor.
Hello, Magnus said to the monkey.
The monkey did not reply.
I shall call you Ragnar, Magnus added, leaning back against the pillows gently. Claude!
The door opened and Claude came in. He did not appear in the least bit surprised about Ragnar's presence. He just immediately set to work cleaning up the spilled tea.
I'll need you to get a leash for my monkey, Claude, and also a hat.
Of course, monsieur.
Do you think he needs a little coat as well?
Perhaps not in this weather, monsieur.
You're right, Magnus said with a sigh. Make it a simple dressing gown, just like mine.
Which one, monsieur?
The one in rose and silver.
An excellent choice, monsieur, Claude said, getting to work on the feathers.
And take him to the kitchen and get him a proper breakfast, will you? He'll need fruit and water and perhaps a cool bath.
By this point, Ragnar had hopped down from the foot of the bed and was making his way toward an exquisite Sèvres porcelain vase, when Claude plucked him up like he'd been monkey-plucking all his life.
Ah, Claude added, reaching into his coat. A note came for you this morning.
He made his quiet exit with the monkey. Magnus tore open the note. It read,
There is a problem. It is to be delayed until tomorrow. Axel.
Well, that was the evening's plans ruined. Tomorrow was Saint-Cloud's party. Both of these obligations needed to be met. But it could be done. He would take his carriage to the edge of the Tuileries Palace, attend to the business with the Queen, get back into the carriage and get to the party. He'd had busier nights. And Axel was worth it. Magnus spent far more of the next day and evening worrying about Saint-Cloud's party than about his business with the royal family. The glamour would be easy. The party would likely be fraught and uncomfortable. All he had to do was put in an appearance, smile, and chat for a bit, and then he could be on his way. But he couldn't escape the feeling that somehow this evening was going to go wrong. But first, the small matter of the Queen. Magnus took his bath and dressed after dinner, and then quietly left his apartments at 9, instructing his driver to take him to the vicinity of the Tuileries Garden and return at midnight. This was a familiar enough trip. Many people went to the garden for a chance encounter amongst the topiaries. He walked around for a bit, making his way through the shadowy garden, listening to the snuffling noises of lovers in the shrubbery, occasionally peeking through the leaves to have a little look. At 10:30 he made his way, by following Axel's map, to the outside of the apartments of the long-departed Duke de Villequier. If all went to plan, the young princess and Dauphin would be exiting those unguarded doors soon, with the Dauphin disguised as a little girl. If they did not exit, the plan was already foiled. But only a few minutes later than expected, the children came out with their nurses, all in the disguises. Magnus followed them quietly as they walked through the north-facing courtyard, down the Rue de l'Echelle and to the Grand Carousel. And there, with a plain carriage, was Axel. He was dressed as a rough Parisian coachman. He was even smoking a pipe and making jokes, all in a perfect low Paris accent, all traces of his Swedishness gone. There was Axel in the moonlight, lifting the children into the carriage. Magnus was struck speechless for a moment. Axel's bravery, his talent, his gentleness. It tugged on Magnus's heart in a way that was slightly unfamiliar, and it made it very difficult to be cynical. He watched them drive away, and then returned to his task. He would enter through that same door. Even though the door was unguarded, Magnus needed his glamour to protect him, so that anyone looking over would see only a large cat sneaking into the palace through a door that seemed to blow open. With thousands of people coming in and out, and no royal staff of hundreds of cleaners, the floors were grimy, with clumps of dried mud and footprints. There was a musty smell about the place, a mix of damp, smoke, mould, and a few unemptied chamber pots, some of which sat in the halls. There was no light, save what was reflected from windows, off mirrors, and weakly amplified with crystal chandeliers that were thick with spiderwebs and dimmed by soot. Axel had given Magnus a hand-drawn map with very clear instructions on how to get through the seemingly endless series of arches and largely empty grand rooms, their gilded furnishings either absent or having been roughly appropriated by guards. There were a few secret doors hidden in the panelling, which Magnus quietly passed through. As he went deeper into the palace, the rooms grew a bit cleaner, the candles a bit more frequent. There were smells of cooking food and pipe smoke and more people passing by. And then he arrived at the royal chambers. At the door he'd been instructed to enter, a guard sat by, idly whistling and kicking back on his chair. Magnus sent up a small spark in the corner of the room, and the guard got up to examine it. Magnus slipped the key into the lock and entered. These rooms had a velvety silence about them that felt unnatural and uncomfortable. He smelled smoke from a recently extinguished candle. Magnus was not cowed by royalty, but his heart began to beat a bit more quickly as he reached for the second key Axel had given him. Axel had a key to the Queen's private rooms. The fact was both exciting and unsettling. And there she was, Queen Marie Antoinette. He'd seen her image many times, but now she was in front of him, and altogether human. That was the shock of it. The Queen was a human, in her sleeping dress. There was a loveliness about her. One part, no doubt, was simply the training she had had, her regal bearing and small, delicate footsteps. The pictures had never done justice to her eyes, though, which were large and luminous. Her hair had been carefully coiffed in a halo of light curls, over which she wore a light linen cap. Magnus remained in the shadows and watched her pace her room, going from bed to window and back to bed again, clearly terrified about the fate of her family. "You notice nothing, madame," he said quietly. The queen turned as he said this and looked at the corner of the room in confusion, then returned to her pacing. Magnus drew closer, and as he did so, he could see how the strain of things had taken its toll on the woman. Her hair was thin and pale, turning brittle and grey at points. Still, her face had a fierce, determined glow that Magnus quite admired. He could see why Axel felt for her. There was a strength there he never would have expected. He wiggled his fingers, and blue flames crackled between them. Again, the queen turned in confusion. Magnus passed his hand by her face, changing her visage from the familiar and royal to the familiar and ordinary. Her eyes diminished in size and grew dark. Her cheeks became plumper and heavily flushed with red. Her nose increased in size, and her chin receded. Her hair became more limp and darkened to a chestnut brown. He went a little further than was absolutely necessary, even altering her cheekbones and ears a bit until no one could mistake the woman in front of him for the queen. She looked as she was supposed to look, like a Russian noblewoman of a different age, a different life altogether. He created a noise near the window to draw her attention away, and when her back was turned, he exited. He left the palace through a heavily trafficked exit behind the royal apartments, where the queen kept a gate open for Axel's nightly entrances and exits. It was altogether simple and elegant, and a good night's work. Magnus smiled to himself, looked up at the moon hanging over Paris, and thought of Axel, driving around in his coach. Then he thought of Axel doing other things, and then he hurried on. There were vampires to see. It was a fortunate thing that vampire parties always started so late. Magnus's carriage drew up to Saint-Cloud's door after midnight. The footmen, all vampires, helped him from his carriage, and Henri greeted him by the door.
"Monsieur Bane," he said, with his creepy little smile. "Master will be so very pleased."
"I'm so glad," Magnus said, barely concealing his sarcasm. Henri's eyebrow flicked just a bit. Then he turned and put his arm out to a girl of similar age and appearance. Blonde, glassy-eyed, dull of expression, and very beautiful.
"You know my sister, Brigitte?"
"Of course. We've met several times, mademoiselle, in your previous life."
"My previous life," Brigitte said with a little tinkling laugh. "My previous life."
Brigitte's previous life was an idea that continued to entertain her as she kept giggling and smiling to herself. Henri put his arm around her in a way that was not entirely brotherly.
"Master has very generously allowed us to keep our names," he said. "And I was most pleased when he permitted me to return to my former home and bring my sister back here to live. Master is most generous in this way, as he is in all ways."
This caused Brigitte to have another fit of giggles. Henri gave her a playful pat on the bottom. "I'm absolutely parched," Magnus said. "I think I'll find some champagne." Unlike the dreary and poorly lit Tuileries, Saint-Cloud's house was spectacular. It didn't quite qualify as a palace, in terms of size, but it had all of the opulence of the decor. It was a veritable jungle of patterns, with paintings packed frame to frame up to the ceilings. And all of Saint-Cloud's chandeliers sparkled and were full of black candles, dripping black wax onto the floor. The wax was then instantly scraped up by a small army of darklings. A few mundane hangers-on were draped over the furniture, most holding wine glasses, or bottles. Most slumped with their necks exposed, just waiting, begging to be bitten. The vampires stayed on their own side of the room, laughing amongst themselves and pointing, as if choosing what to eat from a table laden with delicacies. In mundane Parisian society, the large powdered wig had recently gone out of fashion, in favour of more natural styles. In vampire society, the wigs were bigger than ever. One female vampire wore a wig that was at least 6 feet high, powdered a light pink, and supported by a delicate latticework of what Magnus suspected was the bones of children. She had a bit of blood at the corner of her mouth, and Magnus could not figure out if the slashes of red on her cheeks were blood or extreme streaks of blush. Like the wigs, the Paris vampires also favoured the slightly passé makeup styles, such as the sharp spots of blush on the cheeks, possibly in mockery of the humans. He passed an ashen-faced harpist who had, Magnus noted grimly, been shot.